You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Goombangya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Zambeek. My guest on Talk the Walk this week loves to hear a good story, and I'm pretty sure she'll have some crackers to tell too. Anna McCracken has been travelling around remote Australia, living out the back of her four-wheel drive, listening to the experiences of people with disabilities. Anna's been involved with the NDIS since the drafting of the legislation and following the rollout across Australia since 2013 as a national advisor. Anna is now a driving force behind Balancing Act 3, which equips purpose-driven businesses and organisations from the human rights and human services sectors with the tools and knowledge to transform, innovate, and create services that advance human rights. Anna has been working alongside the NDIA, service providers, and community groups as an influencer of social policy in rural and remote areas. Her latest project began with a conversation in community with Aboriginal elders, where she was sharing one of her passions, virtual reality. Anna immediately identified the opportunity to capture the beauty of country and narrative all in one using VR technology, with community becoming her collaborators in the design of a learning and language development tool. Anna once said she works to travel and travels to work. Sounds like the perfect job, Anna. Thank you for coming onto the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you take us back to when you first started practicing social work? What were you noticing about social policy in remote and regional Australia during your travels?
It's hard to reflect, I guess, back to that time without having all the experiences since sort of compounded. But I do remember my first experiences of social work were that no matter what was happening at a community level and the ideas that were coming up, it just seemed that the programs that would run and the initiatives that would get off the ground that people wanted would sort of last for 6 months and sort of the funding would stop and then last for a year and then the funding would stop. And looking, I guess, going from that grassroots level and then looking at the layers above that and decision making, there was just such a mismatch between the realities of the ground and the social policy and the legislations that were sort of over the top of that. And I guess it seemed to me that social policies in a way were oppressive and some of our legislation in the country was driving that. And resourcing was being decided and social policy were being designed by people that were so far away, not just geographically, but from culture and from understanding. And it was, I think, in social policy that I was looking at by its very nature was continuing to do to people. And that is sort of been the driving force of all my work, is frantically trying to get us away from this culture of doing to and doing for people and looking at what true authentic partnership means. So, yeah, I guess because I'm curious about everything, I wanted to find out more. And I think at the time I was disillusioned by the concept of human rights and human rights law and what that might look like at a, if I could sort of have both social work and a human rights background. And so that sort of took me off the path for a while to do human rights law.
Yeah. So what was the driving force behind you going back to undertake your master's in human rights? Was it basically what you were seeing on the ground, these oppressive kind of policies and this mismatch between what people's experience of those policies were and what the intentions of the policy were?
Yeah, definitely. I think I felt powerless. I'm also quite aware of, questioning what my role was in rural remote communities. So, I mean, I'm not from the community and I was drawn to the work, but didn't really know what my role was. And I wanted to understand from, I guess, my background as a white middle-class girl to how I could, where my place was and also what had shaped my own place in that. And a lot of that was around legislation and laws that have been in place for so long. So it was a personal quest, but also this professional quest to better understand and start a bit of a movement for myself that I mean, social policy should never happen without having deep understanding and also an ongoing role on the ground. I just don't think that social policy should be happening completely separate from the work that's happening in communities, which is pretty much the way it happens. And so I wanted to have a balance where if I moved into the social policy space, I would be working on the ground at the same time as informing policy. But to create that loop, I think I knew I needed to study more or to sort of access some more knowledge around how policy worked.
So can you tell us about what it was that the human rights law masters provided for you in terms of deep learning, not just professionally, but also personally?
The human rights law gave me this understanding of what's known in human rights as, it's called the boomerang effect, which essentially is that a lot of social change happens when a country, so there's a movement from within the country, and then it's sort of the movement, you pull in like transnational, at a transnational level, I guess, people that are also pushing for the change from other countries, and pressure is then put on the country themselves to change. So, for example, if you look at the National Disability Insurance Scheme, there was an amazing grassroots movement, the biggest, you know, campaign, Everyday Australia Counts campaign, that was happening in country. But then at an international level at the time, the UN Convention of People with Disability came out, and in 2008, and Julia Gillard at the time, around 2012, was sort of, there was pressure internationally around what are you going to do in disability rights to, I guess, enact this UN convention that you've become signatory to. That was happening at an international level. So we had the change from within, and then it sort of went out as well, and there was an international push to do something. And so it was just a perfect situation of domestic and international happening at the same time, which then was the birth of the NDIS. Mm. I really wanted to understand that more, and that was all happening at the time when I started my master's. But just as I sort of commenced my master's, I became really unwell with an autoimmune disease and was essentially living in a bubble in hospital, and they didn't know what was wrong with me, and I was there for some time and they had nowhere to put me. So they put me on a room on the spinal ward where I spent a lot of my time. And I met a lot of people in the ward who I became good friends with, who, and one lady in particular, Alice, who had gone to work and had an injury and that day and had lost the use of her arms and legs. And she'd been in hospital for 4 years with no medical issues, but that we have a 16-year wait list for specialised disability housing. And because of the way that government was funding services, she didn't fit into any, she sort of fell out of the loopholes. So, like, she couldn't go to day programs or couldn't get picked up for this because she was in hospital and couldn't get there. And there's so many of these barriers to her engagement with the community, and nothing medically wrong, but just a deeply flawed system that she couldn't access housing. And that then really pushed me towards disability rights. It was that experience. But until then, I'd been driven by what I was experiencing in remote Australia. And then I sort of took a bit of a pivot into disability rights because of a personal experience, really. And now I've come back sort of full circle and I'm in disability rights in rural and remote Australia.
Oh, wow, that's an amazing story. And so once you'd finished your master's, was that when you picked up a role as an advisor with the NDIS?
No, I was a policy assistant for quite some time whilst I was doing my master's in, so my main field is in disability rights, but in children. So I was working for a peak body that works with children 0 to 8 that have disability developmental delay. So I started there as a policy assistant, and then a number of things happened within the organisation, and I just sort of almost overnight was propelled into this space of being an advisor across the country for the NDIS rollout. And I was doing that whilst finishing my master's.
And I guess that appealed to you because you do love travel. And I know that you'd done a fair bit of that in the past.
Yes.
So, yeah, that was when you made the decision, yep, I'll take this on, pack up my four-wheel drive and go.
Yeah, I've been travelling for years and years, but definitely for the last 2.5 years have been living out of a suitcase. For a large chunk of that time, I actually took a bit of a break and went to Cambodia to work as an advisor there on social work practice for 10 months. But in between have been back and forth, just floating. really. And then, yes, late last year was a large trip in the back of my four-wheel drive, and that was when the virtual reality world started unfolding.
Before we get to that, can you tell us a little bit about what your role as an advisor like for the NDIS and how this came about and what it was like for you on a day-to-day basis? What is it that you were doing?
The rollout has, I mean, it started as, like I liked the good old days, was a beautiful bubble in the Barwon area of Victoria. And I guess I just started following as it moved across the country. And what my role was traveling around the country was really just, you know, what social workers do well, which is having challenging conversations and actually holding space for people to tell their story and to really deeply listen to that and to collect those stories and then to, I guess, put them in a format that was easy to digest but also to easy to understand to people that were designing the NDIS at the agency, you know, at the Commonwealth level. And that sort of morphed me into what I feel like I've sort of become, which is a conduit. And it's about, yeah, listening to stories and sitting with people, whether it be children or families, service providers, stakeholders. All of them had experiences about disability and taking that and then and shaping it into what the design could look like, how the NDIS would roll out. So that became my role, really, and I still am. I haven't stopped doing that since 2013. So I sort of have my foot in as, you know, feeding back the information to the NDIA, but also continuing to have these conversations across the country to try and, I guess, build a loop that, again, back to what I was saying before, that social policy and design cannot happen if it's not shaped by the ground. So we need to have these platforms and these loops built in so that people's voice and stories is actually shaping the design, it's not being shaped from people sitting so far removed. And the NDIS wasn't supposed to be a one-size-fits-all approach, which is exactly what it's rolling out to be. And so it's more crucial now than ever to get these voices happening so that the scheme, the NDIS, can actually be localised and not nationalised.
Sounds very exciting, and you have lots of influence, hopefully, in being able to shape that as it's rolled out. So can you talk a little bit about what were the sorts of issues people were telling you about and you were hearing in communities that you felt needed addressing, and how did you get those messages back to the powers that be, if you like?
It's been a slow process, I think, but I'm really excited. This year particularly, there's been a real pivot to understanding, because when the NDIS started rolling out, it was happening so fast. And one of the first areas that they were rolling out in was Tennant Creek. And some of the first conversations that we were having there was even just fundamentally, like from a language point of view, no one wants to really engage with something called the National Disability Insurance Scheme. Mm-hmm. And in the context of child and children supports and disability, the banner of allied health supports that are put in place is early childhood intervention. And so my first conversation was you cannot roll out there and use the term intervention, and what does that even mean to people? And a lot of the conversations have been around language, and from a fundamental point of view is the view of disability. So early childhood intervention is amazing that it can, you know, supports early for children can change their trajectory, particularly for children that are developmentally delayed and can have a number of supports to improve their development. But it also requires you to sort of look at a child and say, these are your strengths, but in a year we can get you here, and this can be where you, this can be what you're doing in a year. And that is sometimes been in communities that I've had conversations, is that as you are today is how you are, and that's okay. And this view of where you're going to be in a year and we want to get you here is not necessarily how people were talking. I mean, people had a, children had a role there and then, and that they didn't need to be any better than they were, which is a beautiful view and is actually more closely aligned to the social model of disability, which is where we're trying to go to, which is that it's not the person necessarily that needs fixing. It's that society disables people, and it's the inaccessible environments and the exclusion that occurs on a daily basis that actually causes people to be disabled. It's not the old model, which views people as having deficits and needing to be fixed. So I think language was a big and is a big challenge. I think that the scheme, the NDIS, emphasises choice and control, and those are very subjective concepts. So somehow along the way, choice and control has been decided often by employees of the NDIS, not the individual and the family. And talking to a lady in Arnhem Land, and she eloquently put this, that, you know, choice to her was not six providers coming in and out of community offering these new services. Choice for her was about meaningful choice and whether she could take her family and her child to go get some saltwater grub, and she needed a bit of help getting there because of her child's needs. That's choice for her, and that was what the NDIS was supposed to be about. But somehow choice has become what a planner or what a person decides on your behalf. So it's almost got to a point where we're like retrofitting the old traditional model of disability supports rather than turning on its head, which was the very intention and vision of the NDIS. And lastly, I guess that the scheme is individualised. And so, and many of the conversations I have in communities is that, you know, people are speaking from a place of we and a collective mindset, not an I. And the individualised model is a challenge, as it assigns everything to an individual person, and currently struggles to view this concept of collective thinking and we and the looking after each other. And I think that really needs to change and have flexibility in that, because it just does not make sense to some communities. And I think it's a beautiful thing, and we need to challenge that, because individualised modelling has issues.
And so can you speak about an example perhaps of where you have been able to feedback and challenge some of these ideas around the NDIS, and you've noticed significant shifts in the way that they're thinking and how things are playing out on the ground?
The reason why I've been around in this space for so long and I'm still so passionate about it is that a lot of the people working on the NDIS are, you know, just are so passionate about this radicalising the way disability supports happen, and they want to do things different. But it is a huge, huge undertaking to roll this out in such a short time. And so what happened was initially I think that the scheme was happening so fast that people weren't asking these questions. You know, I refer to it sort of, it's sort of like a sacred pause, that we've got to a position now where we're realising that things aren't working. And I truly feel like the NDIA is saying that quite openly, which is a great thing to say, that we want to do things different and we want to know, you know, how can that look? And they're starting to look at the way that they collaborate and this traditional model of consultations in communities. They're wanting to do those things differently. So it's just refreshing to hear the humble nature of a Commonwealth agency sort of saying, we know that this isn't working. And that's enough, because then it's allows for a conversation to say, okay, we need to have a pause and we need to reflect on what is happening and what we can do different. So I guess an example of that would be even just opening up to the realm of virtual reality, in that for me, as I mentioned before, I often feel like I'm a conduit, you know, this link between communities and the government, and not just the NDIA but state governments as well, because they're all linked to the NDIS and the rollout. And the issue with being a conduit, and I frantically trying to get myself out of a job, because I think conduits shouldn't exist. You know, we should be in a world where communities can have a platform to be able to share their own stories and also be resourced subsequently to lead their own change. But that's another podcast story perhaps. In terms of the conduit, the stories become incredibly, as soon as you take a story from a community and you are sort of explaining what's happening there, or, you know, whatever it might be, it's diluted straight away, because you've taken the story off country and you've taken it away from the person whose story it is, which has always made me feel uncomfortable in itself. But the reason why I started looking at virtual reality is because it's sort of like my role as conduit was literally just putting, so the story would be captured in the headset and I'm just taking that and putting it on someone else's face to, I guess, be immersed in that experience. And that's my role as the conduit. But the story is on country, in language, and it sort of captures all of the narrative. And I wanted to see initially if we could use it as an empathy tool, or a way of really trying to understand that things are different community to community, and this one-size-fits-all thinking, and even the concept of having like a national remote strategy, it can't work if it's just a national remote strategy. It needs to be localized, as I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been really responsive. I mean, the initial project, I was self-funded with the Foria, which is the immersive technology company, and a beautiful friend of mine, Peter Denatris, who's been a advisor to the NDIA since the beginning also. So he's led a lot of the design of the NDIS. He also invested in this to see, looking at new technology and new ways of communities sharing their voice and sharing what they're wanting things to look like.
Mm.
So that's exciting to me, because that's looking at things differently to the way that traditionally social policy has been shaped.
Yeah, so can you explain, I guess, how that process where community are sharing their story and what those stories are being used for? Is it to directly send messages back to the NDIS about how things are playing out here, or is it something else? What sort of stories are they recording?
It's all very new. So as I mentioned, it started last year. I was driving around in my car and I had a couple of headsets on me, and I was driving through the Western Desert, then up to the Kimberley. And I actually at the time was basically just having conversations with communities about the disability supports and trying to map out what things look like in WA, which is where I'm from, so it's sort of where my heart is, about what an NDIS could look like and what some of the potential issues were, to then link that back to the NDIA. And so I was carrying around these headsets and I wanted to see if people actually wanted to, like, what they thought about the technology first, if virtual reality was actually something that people wanted to engage in. Mm. And the interest was huge. People loved it. And there was one child, he was in the Western Desert, and he put the virtual reality headset on, and the footage was Foria had created some footage for Parks Victoria. So there was a couple of national parks. And what he was looking at was a waterfall in the forest in the Otways in Victoria. And then the next image was him sort of roaming around in Wilson's Prom, where he was watching the sun rise. And he was fascinated because it was in WA and he's in the desert. The sun sets on the west, and also there are no waterfalls in the Western Desert. Mm-hmm. So he was really interested about that country and wanted to know where it was. So we pulled up a map and I was showing him Victoria, and then he was saying, you know, can you show kids there about my country, and can we capture where I live and you could show them? So these started conversations that I had not even thought of, which is perfect. And I think this is what a lot of my work is when I sort of, being nomadic, because I just roam, I don't have an attachment to an outcome, and I had no idea what having these headsets in my car would lead to. I just wanted to see if people were interested, but I hadn't attached myself to any sort of wanting it to look a certain way. So It started that conversation, and that conversation just started to grow and grow and grow as people were really interested in what the land looked like in Victoria and all of these different elements. So by the time I got up to the Kimberley, we had Foria, they were going to come up and we were going to spend a week, and we didn't know if anything would happen or something would happen. But we had a community meeting in a community up in the Kimberley, and basically just explained the technology. And it was a room of about 15 women, five language groups, and they'd all engaged with the technology and all really liked it. We had a conversation about saying, all right, so we're here for a week. What's something that we might be able to capture, something that you're wanting to voice at the moment?
Mm.
We could potentially start there and see what happens. And so the thing that they were voicing was wanting a language centre and wanting to capture some of their stories in language, in the five language groups, so that they could show their kids and their children and people that also were living outside of community, so they could connect back. So we did that. So for the next week we filmed and recorded narratives and country in language, and that's sort of where it's got to at the moment. And from an initial idea, what it sort of turned into is really a language preservation tool. And we're hoping to use that the videos that we have to advocate for resourcing for the language centre that they do want, but it's also turned into its own virtual language centre because you are experiencing the stories in language. So we are now exploring what that might look like with in Northern Territory, and it's sort of expanding from there. So even though I went in there sort of a little bit with an NDIS hat on, and what would be really fun in the future is to explore things that are taking off in America and other parts of the world, is using virtual reality as tools for development for children that have behaviours, you know, social challenges and phobias and challenges with transitioning to environments. And virtual reality is getting some great evidence on being a really powerful tool for that, because so we're wanting to move down that path, but at a very slow pace, and only if that's of interest to the communities that we're working alongside. Yeah, that's sort of where we're at the moment. We have, I think, as it's such a new technology, and something I'm really conscious of is wanting to make sure we're having the conversations about ethics and values, and, you know, of the technology. So the content ownership and what happens if someone passes away, and who owns the different stories and the crossover of language groups. And a lot of that at the moment we're starting to work out. But it's a slow process, and that's really important to me, because I want to build trust not just with us there, of course, but trust with the technology. And I'm still very much, you know, it's not, technology is not something, I still struggle to turn on my computer. It's not something I'm that familiar with. So I'm also building trust with the technology as well, and wanting to not get sucked into it being like a shiny apple new thing, but that that it is actually serving a purpose as a powerful tool for change, and keeping that at a community level and getting people comfortable with it before we start to think about where it's going to go.
So going back to the women that you met with in the Kimberley, where you spent a week starting to record some of their stories and capturing some footage around that area, if I was to put on the headset, what would I be actually seeing? I know that I wouldn't be able to understand the language, but if you could walk through what it actually looks like, or where they're taking us on this journey?
Yeah, many things were filmed and recorded, and you would be able to engage in it because, I mean, some of it's just purely in language, but then English sits just over the top, so you can hear the language if you wanted the English version, but you can also hear the translation, which one of the ladies was translating. But an example of one of them was, we went to the ocean part of the community, and the ladies there led a ceremony with some younger girls in the community. So you would be, with the headset on, you could look around a circle of women who were asking the spirit of the land to welcome them, and to also welcome us there as guests onto the community, and going through a spiritual practice of cleansing their mouths, and then requesting the spirit to sort of welcome them to country as the sun was setting. And that's a really powerful experience. Another one is that one of the ladies had found a bottle, and she found some fishing line, and she found some hooks that were caught on some rocks, and she found some hermit crabs and pulled the hermit crabs out and started fishing. And as she was fishing, she was telling stories about her parents on that land. So with the headset on, you can look around 360 up, down, and completely see the space, and also see her fishing, and then hear her story. So it's sort of like you're standing just on this secluded land with her as she's telling this story, but all the elements are right there and then. And my favourite one is, they had a campfire night. So you would be sitting watching the campfire, and some of the ladies were making damper, and all the children sitting around. So you can look to your left and your right and see the children. And one of the ladies is talking about our way and the school way. So I was talking to the kids about, you know, going to school, but also coming back to community and learning language and all of the cultural things that are important for that community. And she was talking about skin groups as well, and about, you know, if travelling outside of community, to know what skin group you are, and that you belong, and that you always belong back in that community. And that's a really beautiful, moving piece, whilst you're sort of, it's dark and the stars are out and the fire's burning. So there was multiple things that were filmed that really capture the magnificent beauty of culture and country. Those are the stories that they were really comfortable to share. and to get out there, but we haven't shown anyone those that footage yet because I'm waiting to get back up there in the next few weeks to go through it with the community just to make sure that these are the things that they want shared and then to work out who they want to share it with, and they'll be leading that whole thing.
Can you speak about what the women's vision is for using this technology? What are they hoping, or how are they hoping that it might change people's lives, or what difference might it make to their community?
They don't want their language to be lost. You know, that's the vision. And they're worried that there's not enough opportunities throughout the day for children to be learning their language. And they also know that young people especially really love engaging with technology. So it's a way of, I guess, bringing story and language together in a format that young people really engage strongly with. And so providing opportunities to capture that on the headset virtually, I guess, links to their vision of preserving their language and, you know, but having the language in the context of community, I mean, of country as well. So it's all the elements are pulled together. Yeah. That was their real hope, that those languages can continue.
And did you find when you're in the community that accessibility to country is quite difficult sometimes? Maybe people don't have transport to actually go out to particular areas, and might this be a tool to allow people to access it more easily?
Absolutely, that's spot on. I think transport is one of the biggest issues in remote Australia, and the access to go back to country, there's just so many barriers to that, for you know, that you would be so familiar with for so many different reasons. It's interesting that as soon as they put the headset on with even the footage from Victoria, but what we were using as an example, the conversations would just go from like, wow, this is amazing, and then just thinking about all the people and all the avenues of which they could share this to, you know, people that were in Perth in hospital, that people that could no longer access country. They just, just started this, open this can of all the people that they could reach that missed deep, you know, had a deep yearning for country and that really missed it and wanted to connect back to that. So there was just so many examples of that they put on the table of where they wanted this to go.
It sounds like it has so much potential. Have you thought about or talked about what potentially could be some of the downfalls that might take away from your intentions?
The project's going quite slow because there are so many different people involved, and even with, you know, with language groups as well, there's sensitivities around stories, who can tell the story, whose story is it, parts of the land that can be filmed and can't be filmed. But also, as I mentioned before, that, you know, I'm building my trust with technology from a remote context as well. I mean, really working out where the story goes, and once something's on the internet, or even if that's a safe platform, it's those informed consent around story, and then how long is it out there for, and all of those things that wrap around the ethics of it. That's where I'm, I guess, really sensitive to what could potentially go wrong in that space, and wanting to make sure that this is really culturally safe and that people are aware of what they are consenting to, and that they're getting involved in, and how that far that goes, because it's a new realm. And I'm extra sensitive to make sure that people feel really comfortable about this. So there are lots of those ethical issues that we're trying to tease out, that I'm constantly sort of keeping me up at night just wondering, is this an okay space to be in, and am I really thinking about all the implications? But just by having conversations and sharing my fears and sharing what I'm thinking, and like mapping that out with the number of people that are involved that, you know, are just as passionate about it, I think that's a great place to start.
So sharing your fears and really having those difficult conversations, would you say that that's something that has helped you work through some of the challenges around this work?
Absolutely. I think that's probably my biggest learning to date, not just virtual reality, but having the hard conversations and sharing. I share things I'm worried about, the things I think I'm failing at, the things I have failed at, like all of those things I just put out onto the table. And I find that completely liberating. You know, about 8 years ago, I burnt out quite bad and never wanted to do social work again. And reflecting on why that happened to me, it was because I thought I needed to know everything. I thought I did know everything, and I didn't want to openly talk about the things I was really deeply grappling with, which was this issue I've had, lifelong issue I've had with my privilege, and also what my role of helping in this world looks like as a white middle class girl, you know. And I didn't talk about those things, and so they were just like chewing me up because I was reflecting on them but not talking about it. And now I just think having these conversations and questioning intersectionality, questioning our privilege, questioning our role in the world, and then from that place understanding why we want to do the things we do and what's motivating us is how we can like authentically work together, because it comes from a place of, you know, you don't need to know anything really, you just need to be able to have the conversation honestly.
So you mentioned motivation, and yeah, I'm really interested in unpacking this a little bit with you, your drive or your passion or motivation for this work and where this comes from. Do you think you could trace it back to a particular time in your life when, you know, you wouldn't be surprised now you're doing the work you're doing because of what's happened previously?
There's a quote that I heard years and years and years ago. I don't even remember when. It's Lila Watson. She's an Aboriginal activist from the 70s, and she doesn't actually want to take, you know, she doesn't want this quote to be her own. She says it's a collective quote, but she says something along the lines of, and I don't have it in front of me, but if you've come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you've come because your liberation is bound with mine, then we can work together. And that's what motivates me, is that it's I grew up with a wall that was a world map, and I'm from Perth, and Perth wasn't even like a dot on this map. And my earliest, everything in my life has been shaped from this map, not that I didn't see myself as ever being part of a state or a country, but that part of this, you know, magical blue bubble earth, and that we're all actually connected. And it doesn't sit right with me that I, like, my freedom and liberation is bound up into the freedom and liberation of others, and that is a motivating factor. Now, my role in that and what I've thought liberation and freedom looks like has definitely changed throughout the years as I've moved through embodying myself, what it is to do to people, do for people, and do with people. I've been on that journey and felt the disharmony when I've not been like true to, I guess, what authentic partnership is. But that's what it comes down to for me, is that we are all connected and we have some role in working together, and that people exist, you know. And often the dominant conversations and the dominant rhetoric is from a particular group of people, but that people exist and communities and individuals have their own answers. And there needs to be a place for all of us to be able to speak and engage. So that's what motivates me, I think.
So apart from your experiences over this time, are there any particular people that have really influenced your development in this work?
I think my two greatest role models are my grandparents. So my grandparents moved to Australia with my dad when he was 10 because he had chronic health issues and he needed to be in like a hot, dry desert. So they moved to Wyala. But my grandfather was honestly the kindest person I've ever met, and he had a genuine interest in everyone and time. He had time. He was never running somewhere, or nothing was ever like structured in that he couldn't sit with someone for as long as they needed and just chat. And time's a big thing for me now, because I think that we're obsessed with time, but if we don't allow space for people to come forward and speak, which and to have a seat at the table, which takes time and which takes trust and requires you to just sit, then it's only going to be sort of type A personalities that continue to speak, which is me. Time is needed, and he loved the chat. And I think as a young girl watching him, the way he engaged with the world and then how the world engaged with him, because he was so unashamedly himself, influenced me significantly. And everything was hilarious. He was very playful, and he was also very creative. And he was a welder and built furniture, and I subsequently have, as my outlet of self-care, have learnt to build furniture, and I've just finished learning how to weld. So I really am becoming mini pop. But it's the I think it's the creative outlets and being able to build things and use a very different part of my brain to create and to see outcomes in a different way, which is the balance that has really helped me. But yeah, he's been a big influence, and it's mainly just about his authenticity and his kindness. And I think those two things are my favourite qualities in a person. I also love philosophy and poetry as well, and that's sort of come from my grandma. Yeah, poetry and philosophers like Hannah Arendt is someone that I love her work, and David White and Mary Oliver and E.E. Cummings, they're some of my favourites. And I often go to poetry to, I guess, in the middle of the night when I'm having these ethical issues and wondering what on earth I'm doing. Those are my friends that help me or guide me.
Can you speak a bit more about these ethical issues, the things that keep you awake at night? I'm gathering these are some of the challenges of the work. And, yeah, tell us about what it is you're grappling with and what sort of skills or knowledge or values that you're using to work through those challenges.
Gosh, it's a big question. I mean, I think deeply about things a lot. It's just constantly going back to what is my role in this and what is my place, what is motivating me, and really where do I belong? One of the things, so I don't associate with myself really strongly with being Australian, but I do associate with being English because that's my family are English. And wherever I go, I always start with the question of whose land am I standing on? And that then takes me down a path of finding out, it always leads me back to traditional custodians, no matter where I am in the world. But in the context of Australia, for example, it leads me there. Then I obviously learn the history of where I've got to where I'm reflecting on this question. And those are the questions that keep me up, because it's finding this balance between, like, the things that we have done as a country and then the ways forward that we're going to heal from this and how we are, how healing can take place. And that if the role I have in working with communities, if I'm taking steps towards healing or if I'm not. And I think, because I think so deeply about things, sometimes I can look at things from different angles and find myself at different positions. But again, just having the conversation about this, and really, I mean, the virtual reality experience was a good one in that, and as I mentioned before, not having an outcome in mind, but allowing it to unfold where they were, you know, choosing the sites they wanted to film, choosing the stories they wanted to do, and choosing the issue they actually wanted to convey, when we just sort of sat back and set up the camera and, you know, just sort of watched the magic unfold. That was a really amazing project, because that's the way I like to work. But it's been the same. I went to, as I said before, I went to Cambodia for 10 months, and these were the sorts of questions there. I went there as an advisor of social work practice, and something that's happening in Cambodia at the moment is that they are, you know, since 2012, people can now do their social work degree. It's becoming a profession now. But the best social work I've ever seen in my life is happening in Cambodia in the villages, and it's people that have been doing it for 10, 15 years who have an unbelievable skill set. And the skill set is the essence of social work, which is human relationships. And sometimes watching, being in the country and watching social work profession evolve in a under a university banner, and looking at the theories and frameworks that are wrapped around just the essence of building relationships, and how this is affecting the confidence and the careers of true social workers that have been in the village that might not have the degree but are definitely doing the best social work I've ever seen. And this friction that's happening between emerging social workers with the degree and people that have been doing the work. And then my role as an advisor, and not from being from the country and not being from within the community, and how I could support in some way, but with also being mindful of getting myself out of a job quite quickly because it wasn't my role to be there and I guess it's just, it always comes back to what is my place here and what is my motivation, and that's what I constantly reflect on. But I do have a place and I do have skills to share, and I think the role of conduit once made me feel quite uncomfortable, but that's actually something that I'm really quite good at, and that is the skill that I can bring to to the work, which is to listen deeply to stories and stories that people are wanting to share. I have a strong network of people, and through those networks and my relationships, I can convey those stories and hopefully generate some change.
So I am aware of the time, but just a couple of last questions. Going forward, looking at what the future holds for you, how might you be taking these lessons, these reflections that you're having, and your skill set and what you have to offer? What's the future hold for you?
I'm having an absolute blast. I think roaming around and problem solving with communities, and my vision for the next year and a half is collating a lot of stories and asking the questions of communities of how do you like problems to be solved? How do you like your own problems to be solved that you're facing, and what does community driven solutions look like, and how can people engage in that? So I'll just continue to roam around really and have conversations and see what unfolds. I think that's the beautiful thing of the nomadic lifestyle, is that you just have, as my grandfather had, genuine interest and a lot of time to sit, and sometimes those conversations evolve into some light bulb moments that we then think, yeah, let's test that out, and then we test it out. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
I'd love to come back and chat with you again in 12 months or more and see what you've been doing.
Yeah.
So just looking back, what is your sparkling moment? What's something that stands out for you?
As I mentioned before, I went to Cambodia and I was there for a period of time, and I'd said to my colleague that I was working alongside that when the time comes that I'm, you know, not helping you anymore, like, tell me and I'll be on my way. And he had a number of things that he was really interested in, social theories and frameworks, and that was a lot of the work that we did, was to put some frameworks and some around the work. But at the end of it, he said I asked him for some feedback about how the experience was, and he said to me, after the whole time we worked alongside each other, you never tried to make the shape of me the shape of you. You never tried to make the shape of me the shape of you. And that was my proudest moment, because I knew from that I had not projected any of my own judgments, assumptions, beliefs or anything, and tried to make anything into something I wanted, that it was his own experience and it was the community's own experience. And I think that was the proudest moment of my career.
It sounds like the words of Lilla Watson are ringing out across your life and showing up in different ways. Thank you so much for coming along and sharing your journey of social work and human rights work. And, yeah, thank you for all that you're doing in the world. I wish you luck in working yourself out of a job over the next 12 months.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I look forward to chatting with you again someday.
Thank you for having me.
So if people want to follow up with you either online or in person, is there a way they might be able to do that?
I am on LinkedIn, and I do share my travels on Instagram, which is Wild Grace Movement.
So I'll put a couple of links up there on our show notes today. So if people want to track you down, they can find you and follow you. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.